From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. HBO's Sex and the City just won its third consecutive Golden Globe Award for Best TV Musical or Comedy Series. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Michael Patrick King, the executive producer of Sex and the City. He's also written and directed many episodes. Before Sex and the City, he wrote for Murphy Brown and was a consulting producer on Will and Grace. Current series like Sex and the City, The Sopranos, and The Simpsons are being released on DVD. TV critic David Bianculli reviews some of these new box sets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Enron Corporation says that FBI agents and federal prosecutors are investigating allegations that Enron destroyed documents relating to a federal probe of its stock collapse. The federal team showed up at Enron's Houston headquarters today after a former Enron executive charged that Enron had been shredding documents. President Bush said today it's outrageous that Enron employees and investors were kept in the dark about the company's troubles. The president revealed that a family member had lost thousands of dollars as the company went bankrupt. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president was touring a factory in West Virginia when he was asked about Enron. He said his administration has handled the issue properly. He said the White House will not reveal details of meetings between Enron officials and his Energy Commission. And he had this news about one particular Enron shareholder.
My mother-in-law bought stock last summer and is not worth anything now. If she'd have known all the facts, I don't know what her decision would have been made, but she didn't know all the facts.
Later, the White House said Jenna Welch, the mother of the First Lady, actually made the stock purchase in the fall of 1999. 200 shares at almost $41 each. She sold them last December 4th for 42 cents a share. Her total loss, $8,100. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Israeli police say they shot and killed a Palestinian gunman who opened fire on Israelis waiting for a bus in downtown Jerusalem. Members of the militant Al-Aqsa Brigade said the gunman was one of their members. Police say the gunman wounded at least 16 people. Earlier today, Israeli troops said they killed four Palestinian militants. John Walker Lynn, the American who was arrested with Taliban forces in Afghanistan, is said to be on his way back to the United States. Walker's been held for the past several weeks on a U.S. Navy ship in the Arabian Sea. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
John Walker Lynn volunteered to fight alongside Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda forces, and he's been indicted here on charges of conspiring to kill Americans. He's been held for about 2 months on a U.S. Navy ship, but defense officials say Walker has now been moved. At the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld confirmed that Walker is no longer considered a U.S. military prisoner.
Mr. Walker has been turned over to the Department of Justice. He will go where they want him. He will not go to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Rumsfeld said Walker, at some point in the days ahead, will arrive at the U.S. detention facility for the Northern District of Virginia, the jurisdiction in which he'll face the conspiracy charges. U.S. officials will not say exactly where or when Walker is due to arrive in the United States. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
In stocks, the Dow lost 58 points to close at 9,713. The NASDAQ lost 47. This is NPR News. The Securities and Exchange Commission says a major Wall Street company has agreed to pay $100 million to settle a federal investigation. The SEC accused Credit Suisse First Boston of charging excessive commissions to big customers who wanted to buy shares in hot.com companies during their initial public offerings. In effect, federal officials say the company was allocating the IPO shares in exchange for a share in the profits. Credit Suisse First Boston didn't admit or deny the charges, but it agreed to pay $100 million and change the way it allocates IPO stock. Retail giant Kmart may close as many as 500 of its 2,100 stores. Kmart is planning to reorganize it as it files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Kmart shoppers in New Jersey say they're saddened by news of the company's problems. Lynn Richmond reports.
The Kmart in Brick Township, New Jersey, has been a landmark of the town for years, with many people growing up shopping at the store. For Karen Powner of Brick, the retailer was a large part of her life when she worked there for 7 years during the 1980s.
I'm disappointed. It's a staple of the town, but I don't think Kmart Corporation has kept things up, you know, with the times, so that's probably why it led to their demise.
The opening of stores like Walmart and Target nearby helped contribute to the decline of Kmart. For NPR News, I'm Lynn Richmond in Brick, New Jersey.
The former head of the upscale retail chain Neiman Marcus died today in Dallas. Stanley Marcus was 96. He joined the company in 1926. During his almost 50-year tenure at the store, Neiman Marcus adopted the tradition of offering extravagant his and hers Christmas gifts. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and it's good to be back after a bad cold and laryngitis. My guest, Michael Patrick King, is the executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City. He's written for the series since it started. He's also written for Murphy Brown and was a consulting producer for Will and Grace. Sunday night, Sex and the City won its third consecutive Golden Globe as the best musical or comedy series, and its star Jessica Parker won a Best Actress award. Sex and the City is now completing its fourth season, and the four women at the center of the series have gotten older and have changed. Miranda, the lawyer, is still single, but she's very pregnant. Charlotte, the former gallery owner, has married and separated. Samantha, the sex-obsessed publicist, has actually fallen in love. And Carrie, who recently got engaged to her boyfriend, Aiden, decided on this week's episode that she's not ready for marriage. She had the revelation after trying on a wedding dress and breaking out in hives. Here she is with her three girlfriends.
My body is literally rejecting the idea of marriage. Just look.
Yeah, once you get a rash from a guy, it's time to heave home.
No, it's not him. It's me. I'm missing the bride gene. I should be put in a test tube and studied.
It's not just you. I don't want to get married.
Ever? Oh. Why do we even have to get married? Why? Give me one good reason. Aside from the not wanting to die alone thing. Which is something to think about, I admit.
Well, for me, when it was good, it gave me a sense of security.
But I feel secure now. Things are great with us. And you know what they say, if it ain't broke,
don't marry it.
What are you afraid would change?
I don't know. Nothing? Everything? Every bride feels that way at one point. Well, why aren't they speaking up?
Carrie, I'm going to ask you an unpleasant question now. Why did you ever say yes?
Sex and the City's executive producer, Michael Patrick King, told me why the writers decided to have Carrie get involved in a long-term relationship in the first place.
If we brought a new guy in, we'd have to go over the same, you know, defense mechanisms that any character would have. Whenever you fall in love with somebody for the first time or you start dating, you get to delay the reality of who you are for about 6 months, I think. And then the real stuff starts to come out. And we thought, well, rather than bring another new guy in for Carrie, let's bring Aiden back so we can really go beneath the surface of where we've already gone and try to figure out what happens to her when someone really starts to get close.
I'm going to stop you right there. That's very perceptive, what you just said. That when you fall in love with someone new, you can delay the reality of who you really are for a
Well, you know, there's that philosophy that the real person doesn't show up until 6 months in. Up until that, for 5 months, you're just projecting who you think they are on them.
Oh, and the other thing is you can do what Richard Price calls the wonder of me for those first few weeks, a few months, where you tell all the great stories about yourself as if for the first time.
Yeah, and the best of you.
Exactly.
From your best CD of how you talk about yourself on a date. The other thing that's also very effective is on the first couple of dates, you perform your one-man show, which is you're so interesting at them, which makes a delay. You really don't know who. All you know is you're falling in love with you when you're talking to somebody else because they're telling you how interesting you are. So we thought, okay, we've done all the initial bull that you do when you meet somebody, and now we're bringing a guy into Carrie's house and into her life, and she has all sorts of baggage with him. And now it's like if it was a creme brulee, we can go right through the coating and into the goo and see what's there. So the first thing we wanted to do in this season was bring Carrie right up against her intimacy and her actual dreams of who she is as a person and what she wants out of life. So we moved Aiden as close as we could physically and as emotionally to her. And also we made pretty sure that Aiden was pretty close to perfect. which then we gave him a couple of flaws. But we thought it would be really great if she was the flawed one. As with all the girls on the show, what we try to do when we're writing is show that they're the problem. We give guys symptomatic issues, but how the girls deal with them is fundamentally who they are. And that's the fun stuff for us, is to point out the difficulties the women have in being with someone.
Now, what about Miranda? Who decided to make her pregnant?
God. The universe, us. We thought, okay, what's the worst thing we could do to Miranda? What's the most challenging thing we could think of? And we thought to give her a baby would be really challenging because it would bring up all the stuff that she couldn't write off with a man. And as we wrote we're in the beginning of the fifth season, writing the fifth season now, we struggled for a long time about what's Miranda and the baby going to be like? What's that relationship? And we realized it's just another relationship with another man. You know, sometimes she thinks, you know, it's his stuff. I'm there. It's all the baby. And we thought if we brought a baby into Miranda's life, the edges would have to smooth out or she would go a little bit crazy. And we thought she was the most stubborn and the most set in her ways. And good storytelling would then hopefully lead to the fact that we would bring in someone who would shake her to her core.
And, you know, now that you've lived with these characters for how many years? 4 years?
Well, 4 years. 4 years.
And now that they're in their mid-30s and not their early 30s, do you feel like they have to be single in a different kind of way than they were when they were younger?
Yeah, the thing is what we try to do, and, you know, this, of course, added with the writer's imagination, but what we try to do is imagine, you know, what a good story would be, but based on what might really happen to these women in real life if they weren't on television. What sort of bold steps would they make? And that's why we married Charlotte to Trey, because she would be married. That character, looking the way she looks, with her set of her checklist of what she wants out of life, would just get married. And so we thought, well, what would happen in life if Miranda did get pregnant and she was 36? What would she really do? She'd probably think, oh, this is maybe my last chance. Miranda has a weird ovary, and so we just try to follow the impulse through. And with Samantha, what we thought might be nice is if she risked the ultimate for her, which would be love, rather than just, you know, crazy, unbridled sex, which everybody loves her for. And the thing that's so amazing about the episode where she actually falls in love on the rooftop is that people really responded to that. And the thing that I think is so amazing is it took us 4.5 years to give her that moment.
Right.
Whereas sometimes on network television, they say in the third episode, she has to be in love. We have to know that she has the ability to love. We don't like her. She's too surface. 4.5 years later, she finally maybe leaps into a guy's arms. You know, I mean, she tried fake love. She had a love with Sonia Braga playing a lesbian character. But that was just for us to make sure to show that it's Samantha who has a problem with intimacy, not sexuality. But for her to fall deeply in love with somebody, we thought, oh, okay, and it's time. And people seem to be ready for it. We were.
Now, Sarah Jessica Parker starts these new episodes engaged, but by the end of the third episode, she's realized she's not ready for marriage.
That was so difficult for us.
Yeah, and when she tells Aiden that she's not ready to marry, then he thinks the whole relationship needs to be ended. He's not going to stick around if she's not ready to commit.
Right.
And that's like a real surprise for the viewers. I'm just wondering what kind of conversations happen behind the scenes between the writers in making what, for the character, is a really big decision like that.
Well, there's two. The Carrie thing was really huge because the year before we had Carrie in a situation where we had her have an affair with a married man and have an affair on someone who deeply loves her and everybody felt was a really good guy. That was a real trick. It was almost like a Greek myth to get her into hell. And how do we get her out with people still liking her? And because there's very rarely been a woman hero who's done the bad thing in television. So what was tricky for us was once we got her in there was how to get her out with people understanding that she made a mistake and she's human and all that stuff. And because Sarah Jessica is so amazingly luminous and likable and real, she did a lot of the work. And then we were able to sort of chart Carrie's own. We punished her. And the really tricky thing was this year was to get Carrie out of an engagement to a man who she had already hurt, and trying to figure out in the room with all the women writers and myself, was trying to figure out, do women want to be married? Would they just go there? What is wrong with saying you're not sure if you want to be married? And that was the really heated discussion. And whenever we hit like a hot button in the room like that, I always try to chase it down because one of the writers, Julie, who's in the room, has been living with a guy for a long time and has no idea about getting married. She gets red. And I'm sort of like, what? You don't have to be with someone in order to be fulfilled. And then other women in the room were like, no, she should marry him. So it was a real excitement to try to figure out why she wouldn't marry him. And we had, when we came upon the thing of giving Aiden the push, when he starts pushing her, and it was because he didn't trust her and he wanted to own her. And I went up to our prop master, Travis, who is a guy married, and I said, what if she took the ring off her finger? What would Aiden say? Because Carrie wears the ring on a necklace. That was our first symptom that something was wrong. She was trying to distance herself from traditional marriage by making it jewelry rather than a commitment. And he said, no, I would want that ring on that finger because I'd want to lock this down. I'd want the world to know she's mine. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, that's very male. And a woman wouldn't want to hear that. Maybe.
Why did she have to get out of this relationship in the first place for the larger purposes of the series scripts?
Okay. Well, for the larger purposes of the series, I don't think Carrie can be married yet or ever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Carrie is the eternal single girl. Carrie is the smart, sexy, funny, nice girl who can't get it right. So that all the smart, sexy, funny, nice girls who watch the show think, yeah, I get it. You're like me. Yeah, I don't know what my problem is either, but you're pretty good. So I guess I'm not a freak.
Now, I kind of figured that this relationship couldn't last for too long because John...
Terry,
listen. No, John Corbett, who plays her boyfriend, is always getting guest star status in the credits.
Well, now
so
that's...
if he's not a permanent cast member, something's up.
Chris Noth is always guest star. None of the men
ever
be stars on our show. They are stars in our hearts and stars in stories. But guest starring, mm-mm. It's the one rare show where the men are the revolving door. I mean, go back on television and look at all the women, how they just go, you're in, you're out. Get out. Next. Next. Okay, bring in a lovely woman in, and she's done. Get her out. Get her out. So we're the – get a guy in, and get out. Get out. Get out. We're done with you. I mean, it's the girls will always be the stars of our shows.
My guest is Michael Patrick King. He's now the executive producer of Sex and the City and writes episodes as well.
And directs, Terry.
And directs, yes.
Come on,
you.
Give it up.
Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Patrick King. He's executive producer of Sex and the City. He's also one of the writers and directors, and he's been with the series since the start. What are some of the conversations that you've had behind the scenes about how to talk about sex on Sex and the City? Because the four main women characters talk about sex all the time, particularly when they meet at the luncheonette.
Right.
And also of what kind of sex to show, because you also show them in pretty non-explicit ways having sexual relations.
Right. We talk about the sex because we, you know, my feeling is that one of the reasons that people are excited about seeing the show is that we say stuff about a week before people say it. That's it. We're just like a week ahead. If we were 4 years ahead, people would say, they're crazy, and turn off the television. You know, there's no, it's when we do something like Tuchus Lingus, which is self-explanatory if you have a Yiddish dictionary near you. If not, it's about attention to the bum. Is that polite enough for NPR?
I think the bum. Okay. Yeah.
We've talked about it. Now, you said, how do we talk about sex? Well, the first thing is we decide we're going to talk about this topic because it's in the air. We feel it's in the air and it's a little bit edgy. And primarily and foremost, and it's relatable, and then we can make it be funny. And the four girls, if you notice, it never talk about sex the same way, ever. When we want to send up a firework are really shocked someone, Samantha, opens her mouth. When we wanted to show a really strong opinion about it, it's usually Miranda. When we want to show the audience's reaction to it, the more conservative reaction to, Charlotte will pipe in. And then we want to show the people that are sort of trying to figure out what they feel about what we're saying, it's usually Carrie. Carrie is the listener, the sorter, outer. So when we say, how do you write about talking about, how do these women talk about sex? Well, they talk about it completely differently. There's like a very X-rated high school debate at the coffee shop. I mean, it's like the pros and cons of this or that or that. And then how do we show it and why do we show sex? The primary reason we show sex on the show is for a laugh. It's very, very rare to find a sex scene on our show that doesn't have a laugh attached. You will find a romantic scene. You will find a kiss. But when it gets into a sexual arena or there's nudity involved, usually it's for a laugh, to make fun of the actual shame of sex. I think one of the great joys for me in writing the show is that we're able to put some comedy energy, some positive light around these taboo, shameful areas. I mean, I never, ever had a sexual discussion in my family, with my family, at all. My father took my sister Eileen and I into the living room once when we let our dog out because we wanted her to get pregnant, because we wanted puppies. And then we pretended we didn't know what we did. And he took us into the living room and he said, now I'm going to tell you the facts of life. Girls, keep your skirts down. Guys, keep your pants up.
That was it?
That was it. Never had a talk. And I have discussions with my mother now, who is 78 and Irish Catholic and living in Pennsylvania, about sex that you cannot believe. The episode the other night where Samantha took off her clothes on the rooftop and Richard took off his clothes, and it was our first little glimpse of male frontal nudity on the show. She said, oh, I love the show up to the strip. She said, but, you know, my generation, we don't like that stuff. But the fact, the reason we did the strip tease was to show that they were evenly matched. And we were always trying to show that people, that the women on the show actually meet their match. And if Samantha's going to drop her clothes, it would seem, you know, just to cut behind him and show the pants falling seems like a manipulation.
Now, you said that you didn't talk to your family much about sex when you were
Mm-mm.
growing up.
Mm-mm.
But what about with friends? Did you, you know, or at least...
Do we talk like this?
Well, after you came out, would you ever have the kind of conversation with friends that the women in Sex and the City have with each other?
Yes, but the catchphrase to that is you only talk about people that you're having sex with like that before you fall in love with them. as soon as it seems like they might be able to go to dinner with your friends, it's suddenly you're all, you know, quiet.
That even comes up in Sex and the City.
Yes, it does.
You know, there's
Prime. That is why it came up, because we were talking about it in the room, because two of us, I'm in love right now, and so is one of the other writers, and I notice I'm like, very quiet. Very quiet. It's only good afterwards. You know what I mean? It's only good at the other end of the relationship.
When it's over and you're ready to dish.
Oh, when you're ready to really look at how ridiculous you've been. The great thing about sex, what it does is it brings up all, I guess I'm speaking specifically for me, it brings up everything that you think you've figured out that you really haven't. It brings up insecurities. And the people may be naked on our show, but the really fun of doing the show is that we make them emotionally naked, where they really don't know how to cover up. They don't even know what they're saying, because sex brings up stuff you're not really prepared. You don't have a lot of pat answers about sex. That's what's kind of exciting about writing the show, and what gets people excited, it seems fresh, is because really no one has talked about it.
Now, in an episode that you wrote, you know, right after Carrie's boyfriend moves in with her, she's worried that she can no longer perform her SSB, her secret single behavior. These are all the things that you do when you live alone that you'd be really embarrassed to do in front of your lover.
Right.
I like to make a stack of saltines. I put grape jelly on them. I eat them standing up in the kitchen, reading fashion magazines.
Why standing up?
Oh, it's weird, but it just feels great.
I like to put Vaseline on my hands and put them in those Borghese conditioning gloves while watching infomercials.
Before I was married, I used to study my pores in a magnifying mirror for an hour each night. But I'm afraid Trey will just think it's weird.
Well, he would. You can't do that stuff in front of men. What about you, Lolita? Anything you do you wouldn't want a man to see?
No.
You know I believe her.
You wrote this. Is this something you've thought about a lot, all those secret things that you do alone that you can't do with your lover around?
Yeah, it's really interesting for me. And it seemed to be when I started talking to the other writers about it, the idea that people who are single and have been single for a number of years develop certain things that they fall in love with. And they may be even aberrant. You know, they may be just eating cereal in a bowl without breathing, just eating a lot of cereal, which one of the writers told us that she did. She just likes to put cereal in a bowl and eat it dry really fast. And it's just symptomatic of when somebody moves into your life, how suddenly you're visible. And it's interesting in like a city like New York, where everybody's so in each other's faces that when you close your door, and it can be in any city, when you close your door and you're completely alone, there's a relaxed emotional sigh that goes up, like, no one can see me do this. No one is seeing me do this, whatever it is. And the secret singer behavior we talked about on the show is all accurate to each of the female writers that I was talking to. The gloves, putting on the gloves with conditioning that Miranda does, and then, of course, the comedy writer in me added while watching infomercials. But the actual idea of looking at your pores for an hour, but all that stuff is really interestingly idiosyncratic and personal and somehow embarrassing. The most interestingly, I think, perceptive, accurate thing I've written about myself is when Carrie says at the end of that episode to Aiden, I know this is weird, but please don't talk to me for an hour. I'm going to be behind here. You be over there. And then she doesn't need it.
This is when she comes home and she says, used to coming home alone, and suddenly she comes home and there's a boyfriend.
Right, because
there.
He's in there and he's talking to her,
and she doesn't know how
to process asking for private space. Mm-hmm. So the whole, you know, the thing about our episodes is sometimes it's a huge big deal over one tiny request. She didn't know how to say, I need an hour when no one talks to me, because she's been single so long. She hasn't had to ask for that. So when she actually does ask for it, and he has no problem with it, of course, because it's her stuff, as soon as she gets it, she has like 30 seconds, and she's like, I'm done. What are you doing? And that is accurate, I think, to who I am, the idea that you ask for something. And then and the last line of the episode is, that's the thing about needs. Sometimes when you get them met, you don't need them anymore. And the only reason that is so fun to write is because Carrie, in the series right now, with Aiden, is at the point where she's burned through so much of her initial zhuzher, fancy distraction magic tricks that she actually has to ask for 10 minutes alone.
Michael Patrick King is the executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Michael Patrick King, executive producer of Sex and the City. And David Bianculli reviews DVD box sets of classic and current TV shows.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Patrick King, is the executive producer of Sex and the City and has also written and directed many episodes. On Sunday, Sex and the City won its third consecutive Golden Globe for Best Musical or Comedy Series. Here's a scene from a recent episode. Carrie's fiancé, Aiden, had moved into Carrie's apartment with all his stuff, and there was no room to move. After he pressured her to make more room in the closets by throwing out some of her designer clothes, she retaliated with a tour of his clutter.
Just look at this bathroom. Look at all your shit in my bathroom. Who needs 5 almost empty speed stick deodorants? What are you, a crazy bag man?
They're different smells.
And musk one if you ever wore musk. I mean, look at this stuff. You got old razors, Rogaine. Wait a minute. You used Rogaine? I didn't know you knew.
It's preventative.
But is your hair falling?
I don't want to talk about it! This is my stuff. Don't be going through my stuff.
You were more than happy to go through my stuff.
Oh, your stuff, your bathroom. You always do that. You never want to let me in.
I don't always do anything. And I have let you in.
You're fighting with me about a stupid outfit.
Oh, shut up. It's Roberto Cavalli. I threw it away and I love it. What more do you want?
Shut up. Shut up.
Yes. Shut up.
Shut up. You're telling me to shut up?
Please, just shut up. I am so sick of hearing you talking, talking, talking all the time. Don't you ever just shut up?
I'm going to take a walk.
No. I'm taking a walk. You can stay here with your boxes of shit and your shoe-eating dog, and you can knock yourself out putting on the Rogaine and the speed stick.
Let's get back to our interview with Sex and the City's executive producer, Michael Patrick King.
Now, I've been reading about you. Your mother, when you were growing up, managed a Krispy Kreme donut shop.
Yes.
In Scranton, Pennsylvania.
That is correct.
Now, so many parents really try to keep their kids away from donuts because they're really fattening. Mm-hmm. And if a kid is prone to being chubby, donuts aren't the greatest thing. So did you eat a ton of donuts? Did your mother encourage or discourage the habit?
I would say we ate donuts every single day. My mother worked the early shift, which means she got up at 5:30 and left it. My father worked at night, so he was asleep. And my three sisters and I would do our morning routine, which would be eat donuts, go to school, and promptly fall asleep from the sugar. We would, you know, it would be fantastic. There is nothing really better than a glazed Krispy Kreme donuts. And the interesting thing is that I don't eat any sugar at all now. I stopped eating sugar like 10 years ago. As a rebellion. No, as just, I'm very affected by sugar. But yeah, my mother ran a Krispy Kreme donut shop and then hired all my three sisters to work in it. Did not hire me because I think the idea of me on sugar or around sugar was too much for her.
But my mother, behavior or your
work? Oh yeah, I was very hyperactive. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, I'm standing on the microphone table right now. No, the interesting thing is that my mother, I would know my mother came home from work because I'd walk in and see powdered white footprints across the dining room.
Now, you went to Catholic schools.
I went to Catholic school, yes.
And a Catholic college.
Yes.
Was your family pretty religious?
Yes. They were very religious in the Irish Catholic sense of Roman Catholicism, which is sort of piercingly hopeful and sweetly optimistic that the Blessed Virgin was going to help, as compared to the, like, opera-crazy Roman-Italian, you know, sort of punishing Catholic Church. I got this sort of sweeter Holy Family aspect of the Catholic Church. And then, of course, the nuns really did their job to make sure that everybody had very strong feelings about sex.
Was part of it the Catholicism? Was that part of what made it difficult to come out?
You know, the funny thing is, yeah, the first thing, of course, is to, I don't know if it was the Catholicism as much as admitting in an Irish Catholic family that you actually have sexual feelings. You know, my sisters would have to come out as straight people, I think. In order to say I'm gay, you have to also imply that I might have sex. So I think that was the first wave of actually admitting that there was a sexual life. And then Catholicism. And then after a certain point when you've been perceived as a certain thing for so long, you're just afraid to come out because it makes you feel like everything else you told your friends will then be counted as false, you know? But I really think it was, for me personally, it was an amazing journey just to sort of choose myself over everything.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Patrick King, and he's the executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City, as well as one of its writers and directors. Do you feel like you learned some of the things that you don't want to do, things that have become cliches in terms of writing for TV, from getting started working on other shows before you worked on Sex and the City?
Oh, I know so much about how not to write TV. It's amazing. I had a very blessed experience in that I started on my first really good show was Murphy Brown, and that was at the height of when Murphy Brown was, I started the year she got pregnant, and Diane English, who created that show and ran it, was really spectacular. She had five writers that she respected, and her job as the showrunner, which is the executive producer, is to listen to the voices in the room and find out what they think and then incorporate all those voices into one script. And so I had a really good experience there. So I know what the target was to shoot for. But, I mean, I've had really bad experiences where as soon as you start to open your mouth to pitch an idea, they go, won't work, can't happen, not likable, don't like the character, it's only 20 minutes long, you're trying to do too much, what's the subtext about? You know, I mean, I would drive people crazy because I kept trying to weave stories underneath. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, well, we're going to cut that whole section. And then I'd start going, but then the end is, the end won't work. And I'd be trying to write. And the other thing that's really, really, I think, destructive in television right now is there are very few shows that actually let writers write, where you actually get a writer and say, oh, that's his voice. Let Michael write that one. Let Julie write that. Let Amy write that. It's instead, it's gang, they call them gang-written scripts, where something goes wrong at the table read. These are four-camera sitcoms I'm talking about. I really don't have any expertise in dramas or other one-camera shows, which is what Sex and the City is, which is like a little movie. But these are when you go in front of an audience and the audience is there and they're plotting and they're waiting to hear the big jokes. As soon as something goes wrong, there's a tendency to go back to the writing room, throw out the last 3 months of thoughts that you've all put into this idea, and just go like a pop beat, pop, pop, pop. Put this joke next to this joke, next to this joke, next to this joke. What do you say? What do you say? And it works in terms of it makes people laugh, but it doesn't really give you anything, in my opinion, it doesn't give you anything to believe in or relate to. You're not turning in every week to see what happens to people. You're waiting to see the funny thing.
My guest is Michael Patrick King, executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Patrick King, executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City. He's also written and directed many episodes. Now, you were a consultant on, mm-hmm. on Will and Grace,
yeah.
I think, during the first
I was in the,
season.
We finished the first season of Sex and the City. Darren and I wrote all of them. It was just Darren Starr and I. We did the entire season. And then we were done before they were on the air. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And Max Muchnick and David Cohan, who created Will and Grace, asked me to come over. And I joined them for the first 12 episodes of that series, which was really fun to start because it's an entirely different muscle. And the writing room was really funny. And they're very smart. And it was fun to help begin to shape a new show.
In what sense is it a different muscle than Sex and the City?
It's the Olympics. It's and for years after I you know, Sex and the City came back on the air and I couldn't be on staff of Will and Grace, but I would go over on show night, which is in front of the audience, and they used me as punch up, and I would put jokes in the moment where you're watching a show and you go, maybe if, boom, and everybody's putting jokes in, and you run up to the actors and say them, and they say them back, and the audience hears them. It's really like a vault versus like an Olympic swimming event where you just have to vault, boom, off that horse and you have to hit that mark and you know exactly right now if it worked.
Now, how do you do that without falling into the trap that you were talking about before where it's just like joke, 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 but there's no real investment in the story?
It all gets in. It all comes into the individuals. I mean, joke, joke, joke can be really good too if the jokes are based on character or the person pitching them is unique and funny. But, you know, Will and Grace tell stories and they're a whole other thing. They're like a Millennium Noel Coward or something. I mean, they're all about dialogue and those four characters. And it's, the difference between a network sitcom and what we do on HBO is that network sitcoms are 20 minutes long. 20 minutes, 21 minutes. And I can have my show be 30 minutes. And that seems like only 9 minutes, but that's 9 minutes of character, 9 minutes of story. You know, you get to go a little bit deeper because you have that extra 9 minutes. It really doesn't matter how important the story is because it has to end at a certain time. Whereas I can actually pick up the phone and say to HBO, I need 2 more minutes. I need 2 more minutes. And then we debate about whether I need 2 more minutes, and then I do get the 2 minutes. So, I mean, it's just a different animal, and it's a great, fun muscle in your head to write a 4-camera show when it's really fun, like Will and Grace, because it's very, very sharp, and the mark is really high because the audience needs to hear the laugh. And then the other thing, which is what we do on Sex and the City, which is the girls are sort of they make jokes to make each other laugh. You know what I mean? There are jokes that we say, well, that's too big of a joke. We did a joke about the Guggenheim Museum last year, which is a wonderfully crafted joke between 4 writers. You know, when 4 writers are making a joke, you know it's a joke. But we made a joke about when Charlotte, it was in an episode where Charlotte hadn't looked at her vagina. And she says to Carrie, have you looked at your vagina? And she says, I think of it like the Guggenheim. Whenever I'm in the neighborhood, I stop by and see what's on. But I get confused and a little dizzy. And, you know, we thought, oh, Carrie comparing her vagina to the Guggenheim. It's brilliant. And then when we filmed it, we went, well, that's just a bunch of joke writers sitting in her head, working her like a puppet. A character, Carrie would never say that.
Right. So you
took it out. And eventually the joke turned into, Carrie, have you looked at yours? And Carrie said, how'd I get involved?
Right.
And that seemed more right for our show because it's Carrie's true attitude about it rather than, look how clever we are. We built a joke and now Sarah Jessica's doing it well. And she did it perfectly. But she also did look at me like, is that all right? And I knew, okay, it's a joke. We put a joke in the show. And the writing in our show is more about we get to show off a little bit. If I'm Will and Grace, they get to show off in the jokes. We get to show off in Carrie's column or the narrative. You know what I mean? Or mm-hmm. our turns of phrases. We have our thing, too.
I'm sure a lot of women say to you, particularly about the character Samantha, that women don't care as much about the size of the male's anatomy as Samantha does. So mm-hmm. what do you say when viewers tell you that?
Yeah, I think that there are some women who don't care that much about how their living room looks either. You know, there are some women that are crazy and have everything in their living room turquoise.
Oh, right.
And another woman would walk in and go, why does she care so much about turquoise? Why does the pillow have to match the couch? Why does the rug have to match the wall? And for Samantha, her living room may be a penis.
Right. So which character do you relate to most?
I would have to say that I am Carrie and Miranda. I mean, the interesting thing, Margaret Cho is on the show. She's a wonderful, wonderful comedian and actor and writer. And she says that she thinks she does the Sex and the City Zodiac. She says, I'm Carrie with Miranda rising. So I think they're all in there. I mean, when I'm writing them, I feel that Carrie is the most difficult to write because she's the most integrated. And I would like to think that what we're all shooting for is to be somebody who is all of those characters, somebody who has a great, healthy sex life, someone who believes enormously in romance and tradition. Somebody who is cynical and funny as Miranda, and then someone with a completely warrior, wide-open heart that Carrie just keeps going forward and trying to make the world better for herself and her friends and everybody.
Well, Michael Patrick King, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, it has been my pleasure.
Michael Patrick King is the executive producer of HBO Sex and the City. Our interview was recorded last week when I had a bad cold. Let's listen to a recording by Peggy Lee. She died yesterday of a heart attack at the age of 81. Her biggest hits were Fever and Is That All There Is? We'll hear a track from early in her career, back in the mid-40s, when she was recording with a band led by guitarist Dave Barber, who was then her husband. Peggy Lee singing Don't Blame Me. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews current and classic TV shows, now on DVD. This is Fresh Air. Television series, old and new, are being released in an ever-increasing number on DVD sets. From classics like Your Show of Shows to current series like Sex and the City, TV is finding its way into homes in a new format.
TV critic David Bianculli is all for it, for personal as well as professional reasons.
I can remember being in college in the mid-70s and becoming close friends with one of the film professors. He had a 16mm projector and would lug it to my apartment so that my friends and I could watch movies from his personal collection. We projected them on a sheet I tacked to my wall. Boy, that was the life. A couple years later, I was a full-time TV critic, and Sony released the Betamax, the first home video cassette recorder. It cost $1,700, which at the time was one-tenth of my annual income. But I took out a loan and bought one. It meant I could go out at night and watch the TV I missed when I got home. Better yet, it meant I could watch one show and tape another. Best of all, it meant I could compile my own library of films and TV shows. Who needs a film projector? Who needs a professor? Boy, that was the life. Video discs, the next popular video format, was overwhelmingly used for movies, not TV. But now that the DVD is big business has discovered that it's the perfect format for TV fans. The first two seasons of The Sopranos, for example, have been released in separate boxed sets of four discs each. Each box set is about the size of one videotape, which means in the space on my shelf it now takes to hold two episodes of The Sopranos on video, I can put 26. And they look and sound much better, and won't degrade with time, and are easier to navigate from one scene to another, and have all sorts of special features. The only drawback is that what I'm gaining in shelf space, I'm losing in time. Many of these box set releases feature alternate commentaries on the audio track, so you have to watch them twice, once to see the shows, and once to hear the behind-the-scenes stories. Most of the box sets, too, have extras tacked on at the end, deleted scenes, sample scripts and storyboards, special interviews. You could lose an entire day working through the goodies on just one of these sets. I know, because I have. I've lost myself in Twin Peaks, the first season of which, minus the telemovie pilot, recently was released in one beautiful four-disc set. The video transfer is so gorgeous, the difference is noticeable from the opening credits. Even the steam from the sawmill billows in pulsating ways I never noticed before. And the sound and music, which David Lynch always obsessed over, really come through beautifully. The first season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer was released last week, and that's an especially fun show to revisit. So many people I know have come to this show late, or not at all, that grabbing the first year's worth of episodes on DVD is the perfect way to get acquainted. I've been amazed by the clarity of the digitally restored Sid Caesar DVD sets, and grateful for the well-chosen segments in the Johnny Carson collection, and happy to store so many Sex and the City episodes in one handy package. And perhaps most of all, I'm thrilled to own the first season of The Simpsons. What a great show, and what a wonderful DVD package. All 13 episodes are included, without commercials, of course, and transferred so crisply you can catch all sorts of formerly blurry hidden jokes. Each episode features an alternate audio commentary, which often is as funny as the show. Here are creator Matt Groening, co-executive producer James L. Brooks, and others whose conversation was recorded while screening one of the episodes, Some Enchanted Evening.
Yeah, this is the show that almost killed The Simpsons.
Whatever do you mean, Matt?
Well, we
I remember that day.
We had done 13 episodes, written 13 episodes, and had worked with animators and had all of the episodes in the works before we had seen the results of any of the writing. And all the layouts were done here.
Right.
Everything was shipped off to Korea, so we really didn't know what we were going to get. And so we had a...
6 months later. Now it's
6 months later, we saw the results of that first script, which was this, and...
Well, not this episode, what we're seeing now, but...
Not this particular episode, because this is the fixed-up version. But there's elements of the original episode in here.
Yes, right? There's it's a couple of shows.
What percentage of this would you say is new?
I think about 70%.
70%.
And anything that we had old, we actually had a new background to, because all the backgrounds were kind of...
But we sat there and saw the worst version of The Simpsons. Well, you can't imagine. You can't imagine how bad it was, that you can be a little off and they became sort of grotesque and everything was horrible.
Could the original animation of that first Simpsons episode be as bad as they claim? It turns out you can judge for yourself, because that very animation is included as one of the many box set extras. In my opinion, it was that bad. As terrible as this first Simpsons DVD is terrific. It doesn't surprise me that Groening is so savvy in taking advantage of this new technological format. He's even savvy enough to make fun of it, and us, in his written introduction inside the box set. "Welcome," he writes, "to the first of many deluxe overpriced DVD sets of The Simpsons. With 280-odd shows in the can and no end in sight, you might be able to complete your Simpsons DVD collection just before the next format comes along. Thanks for buying." He's right, you know, but it doesn't matter. For now, this is too much fun, too convenient, too attractive, too addictive. For a few years, at least, this is the life.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of 50 Acres and a Poodle, A Story of Love, Livestock, and Finding Myself on a Farm, a memoir by Jean Marie Laskus, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter David K. Johnston. He won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his reporting on tax inequities and loopholes. We'll discuss how Enron avoided paying taxes and how the war on terrorism has changed the congressional tax debate. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.